From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. After this weekend's deadly terrorist attack in London, the third in 3 months, Prime Minister Theresa May says she wants democratic governments to regulate cyberspace, saying the internet helps recruit jihadi extremists and helps them spread terrorism. Her critics say blaming and regulating the internet is short-sighted and would stifle free speech and open access to information. So how would tighter government controls on the internet work, and at what cost? This hour On Point, regulating cyberspace in the age of terror. You can join us on air or online. Do you think the government should regulate the internet, or would it be at odds with a free and open society? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll be talking about President Trump's doubling down on his travel ban and its future in the Supreme Court. But first, joining me via Skype from Cambridge, England, is Charles Arthur. He's a contributing writer for The Guardian, who has been writing about online extremism. His recent article is entitled "Blame the Internet is Just Not a Good Enough Response to Theresa May." And Charles Arthur, thank you for being with us today. We're very grateful.
Sure thing.
And joining us from Atlanta is Mia Bloom. She's a professor of communication at Georgia State University who specializes in transcultural violence. She has authored several books and articles on terrorism and violent extremism, including Dying to Kill, The Allure of Suicide Terror. Mia Bloom, thank you for joining us today. It's good to have you.
Thanks for having me, Anthony.
Let me start with you, Charles Arthur, just to get the latest from where you are in Great Britain. What does Prime Minister Theresa May want to do? She's talking about getting democratic governments to work together to regulate the internet. What does she have in mind?
That's a really good question. And if I actually had any clue, if she had given any clear indication in her speech, or indeed to the companies who one generally thinks are involved, that is Google and Facebook, because they are the providers of the biggest platforms here, then it would be a lot clearer. But the fact is that in the speech that she made on Sunday morning after the terror attacks, she said essentially enough is enough. The internet, the big companies that provide internet services, need to work with allied democratic governments to reach international agreements that regulate cyberspace to prevent the spread of extremism and terrorist planning. And we need to do everything we can at home to reduce the risk of extremism online. Now, she said that, but it's not actually clear what she intends to do. And from the contacts I've had with people at, as I say, Google and Facebook, they don't really know quite what she means either. And it's worth pointing out that she was the Home Secretary, the Interior Secretary, in effect, for the UK for 6 years previous to becoming Prime Minister back in September. So she should know what it is that she's talking about. She should have a plan of action here.
Well, I wanted to ask you about
that. She doesn't is puzzling.
Yeah, the fact that she doesn't is puzzling. I wanted to ask you about that precise point. Are there any clues from when she was Home Secretary as to what she might have in mind?
Well, there were proposals back in the previous administration, which was from 2010 to 2015, about providing more internet surveillance, that internet service providers would have to collect more data, mobile phone providers, the carriers would have to collect more data about people's web browsing habits, more addresses and so on, and details about when they use their phones, not to the extent of the actual content, but simply what websites they might have visited and so on. That was very contentious. The Liberal Democrat Party, which was in coalition power then, managed to get that held back. But in 2015, when the Conservatives, for which Theresa May was the Home Secretary, came to power, they did push this through. And that has come into action. Now, those powers would seem to give any government enough insight into what was going on for them to be able to look at, and one would have thought, to pinpoint extremism if it was happening. But it's also worth saying that with these most recent attacks, and indeed with the previous attack a fortnight ago in Manchester, it seems that the people involved had been sort of noticed by the community, that people had reported them to the police sometime previously, but no action was taken. And there's actually a lot of focus on whether there are sufficient police, in fact, to actually act on the information that they're given, more than whether more internet surveillance is given.
Mia Bloom, I'd like to come to you and just sort of, lay out the problem here that Theresa May is trying to address. I mean, how do terrorist organizations use the internet to recruit participants to their cause?
Well, first of all, I want to agree with Mr. Arthur. I think one of the issues with Theresa May having been Home Secretary for 6 years is that, according to the data I've seen, 20,000 fewer police officers are walking the beat as a result of some of these austerity programs. Now, the money didn't come from Homeland Security or the equivalent of Department of Homeland Security, but from policing. And I think that he's spot on, as they say in the UK, as far as where the prevention element can be. But the way the internet is being used is not the way Prime Minister May has explained it. Facebook and Twitter and Google, that might have been 4 and 5 years ago, but a lot of what has gone on within, especially ISIS recruitment, but all the jihadi groups, have moved to more encrypted platforms. And so what we see instead is there's a certain amount, perhaps, on Twitter or Facebook, and in fact, last year alone, Twitter shut down over 200,000 different Twitter accounts, but that it's in Telegram, it's in these encrypted applications that are on the mobile phones or on mobile devices that are right now the heart of both radicalization, recruitment, as well as just being used as the propaganda tool. So people will log on, they will join the links that are available to them once they're inside Telegram, and at that moment, what you have is an unbelievable amount of just propaganda, videos, images, things that are intended to cause a great deal of shock and horror, but also intended to get people connected to their computer and not to leave the computer. In many ways, what these terrorist groups are doing is similar to either the kinds of addictions that people have for online gaming or even for gambling, where it's a variable interval schedule of reinforcement. What do I mean by that? They have different kinds of things every minute. So sometimes it's going to be an ISIS-specific emoji, a happy face with a knife, or sometimes it's going to be a sticker, or it's going to be a video, or it's going to be a nasheed, a song, a prayer. It's constantly coming at you, and also the links have a very limited time to respond. So if you don't click on them within 30 minutes to an hour, you've missed out. And it basically causes a kind of attention deficit that you cannot leave the Telegram, because if you leave, you're missing out.
Now,
there's this addiction.
Mia, this is really important. I'm glad you brought this up. I just want to make sure that we're clear about some of these terms so that our listeners are totally with us here. When we talk about encryption, this is a kind of coding, essentially, of messages that can only be read at the beginning and the end point, right? So that keeps the data secure and it can't be decoded en route, essentially. Is that a good way to describe it?
The platforms are encrypted in several ways. The way you described with the PGP encryption, they're also encrypted so that they're not open. It's not like you can do a Google search and get into Telegram and find a particular group.
Right.
You have to already be part of it. The last thing that Telegram does that some of these other encrypted apps don't do, and it's the reason ISIS prefers it, is that you can put a self-destruct timer on the message so that in a direct message, in a private chat, as soon as the person reads it, it disappears forever. So there'd be no archive of it the way, for example, the British Security Services wanted WhatsApp to reveal all of the messages that Khalid Massoud, had sent immediately before his attack at Westminster.
I see. I want to come back to you, Charles Arthur, and just ask you about this sort of, I don't know, I think you wrote about this quite well this morning, actually. I mean, this idea of a bit of a contradiction here in Theresa May's message. I mean, asking democratic societies who want to hold on to free speech and presumably open access to information to crack down on this kind of sharing of information and access to this kind of information. It seems like a potential difficult conflict we're talking about here.
I think that it seems like a deeper conflict in the United States, where the First Amendment is so deeply rooted, than it does in countries like the UK, where the idea that speech is untrammeled is not quite taken in the same way. In the UK, for example, there is a division of the Metropolitan Police which works very closely with the UK outlets of the bigger internet companies, working on identifying radical content and making sure that it gets removed. And it's called the Internet Reaction Unit, IRU. That doesn't exist in the United States because it would be unconstitutional for it to operate, for an arm of the government, in effect, to be telling private companies what to take down. So there are key differences there. In that sense, it's not a sort of contradiction in terms of what the governments have always done, going right back to the times when it was kings rather than governments. But it's more the difficulty in terms of how actually do you do it? How do you define what is extremist content and what is just sort of strongly held opinion? How do you decide what is just something which is is sort of not relevant now, but which you have to think in the long term is going to be dangerous.
Charles Arthur, I got to jump in because we're coming up against a break, but I'm going to pick up this thought after the break. I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook. We're discussing Prime Minister Theresa May's call to regulate cyberspace. You can join the conversation. She made the statement in the wake of the third horrendous terrorist attack in the last 3 months in London over the weekend. Here's British Prime Minister Theresa May yesterday as she called for closer regulation of the internet in the fight against terrorism.
We cannot allow this ideology the safe space it needs to breed. Yet that is precisely what the internet and the big companies that provide internet-based services provide. We need to work with allied democratic governments to reach international agreements that regulate cyberspace to prevent the spread of extremist and terrorism planning. And we need to do everything we can at home to reduce the risks of extremism online.
British Prime Minister Theresa May speaking yesterday at 12 Downing Street. With me from Cambridge, England, via Skype is Charles Arthur. He's former technology editor and now a contributing writer for The Guardian. His piece this weekend is Blame the Internet is Just Not Good Enough Response, Theresa May. And from Atlanta, Mia Bloom, professor of communications at Georgia State University, who specializes in transcultural violence. And Mia Bloom, I want to pick up with you and just ask you to, Charles Arthur put this interesting idea in play before the break, and that is, how do you define what is truly dangerous content versus just controversial opinion? Because that seems to get to the nub of one of the issues that's so difficult in this conversation.
It's absolutely difficult because radicalization or holding radical views or even holding extreme views isn't in itself illegal. It isn't a problem. It's part of the constitutional rights for people to consider themselves radicals. I'm sure most people who voted for Bernie thought they were being radical. It's when it moves from thought to action. And so what we have in the United States, which isn't this UK Internet Reaction Unit, is that many of the companies in Silicon Valley got together and voluntarily pooled resources, Facebook, Google, Twitter, and Microsoft, to create this shared identity database to be able to identify content that was truly horrific. Very graphic images, beheading images, these digital fingerprints for images and videos that are posted by the extremist groups. And in fact, Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg are going one step further, trying to create an artificial intelligence, these these algorithms that would be able to distinguish between what is actually radical, for example, recruitment to terrorism, versus what's just news about terrorism, so that this artificial intelligence is going to be able to read through the materials. But in the end of the day, it's extremely difficult to know at what moment people go from holding violent and radical thoughts to behaving or acting upon them. And that's where the policing that Mr. Arthur mentioned is so important. That's where we have, for example, in the United States, the vast majority of the leads that are called into the police or to the FBI or any of the agencies are coming from within those communities. So it's outreach to the communities, it's having police officers that people can pick up the phone and call and say, I'm concerned about my child. But barring that, we can never anticipate what is going to push someone over the edge.
Mm. I want to go to our listeners in just a moment, but I just want to make this point that tech companies are pushing back, or at least making the case that they are very much engaged in this effort. There have been statements from Facebook, from Google, from Twitter, YouTube. Here is a statement, part of a statement from Facebook. We want to provide a service where people feel safe. That means we do not allow groups or people that engage in terrorist activity or posts that express support for terrorism. We want Facebook to be a hostile environment for terrorists. Using a combination of technology and human review, we work aggressively to remove terrorist content from our platform as soon as we become aware of it. Let's go to Michael, who's calling from Norcross, Georgia. Michael, good to have you.
Hi, Anthony. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say that the UK is widely accepted as, you know, one of the most surveilled countries in the world, yet it doesn't seem to be helping the problem, probably because, as Mr. Arthur and your other guests have said, the cuts in police force. So I don't really see what trying to regulate free speech on the internet is going to do. I also want to say it seems like there's a generational gap where I'm 27, so it seems the people my age who grew up with the internet realize how important it is and how almost impossible it would be to even do what the older generations in power are wanting to do. And I also want to ask your British guest if he thinks that this will have any influence on the upcoming special elections that are going on in the UK. And I guess I'll take all my answers off air.
Thanks. Michael, you put a bunch of great points on the air. Charles Arthur, why don't you pick up that last point first? You do have an election coming up on Thursday. What kind of effect is this having?
The whole question of what has happened to police numbers has been very much in the news today. And Jeremy Corbyn, who is the Labour Party candidate, that is he's the leader of the what I guess you'd call it, sort of the equivalent of the Democrats, though further to the left of that. He has been saying Theresa May should resign because she was the Home Secretary, the Interior Secretary, for 6 years, and that in effect all this has happened on her watch. She has said that she represents the party which would do the most in terms of stability and safety for the country. It's unclear what effect this will have on the polling, which happens on Thursday. It's a general election, so it puts all of the members of parliament will be up for election on Thursday, and we'll have a new government on Friday.
Right. Charles.
Just on the next point, the caller said the UK is the most surveilled state. Okay. Just to be precise, the UK has the largest concentration, I think it is, of CCTV cameras. However, a CCTV camera doesn't necessarily tell you about identity. It doesn't tell you about intent or what people are doing. What happened with the attack on London Bridge on Saturday night was that some people had hired a van and they had bought some knives at a DIY shop. So, quite how you put those together and therefore get to the intent of what they're going to do, you're not going to figure that out from some CCTV. You're going to be able to figure out what they did before from that, but that's not really the same. That's all after the fact. Being able to predict what's going to happen before the fact is rather different. And another point I'd make is that the police say that since the Westminster attack, which was back in March when a man drove a car and hit a number of pedestrians on Westminster Bridge, the police say that they foiled five attempted plots in the time since then. So, you know, the police are not sitting around here. There is actually useful work being done, but it's not perfect.
Mia Bloom, in terms of the response from the tech companies, I read that response from Facebook and all they say they are doing to address this problem. What's your view on what more tech companies need to do to get into this fight?
Well, I've noticed, for example, when the Telegram, if I'm inside these ISIS networks and I'm following along either on the channels or the chat rooms, which is a project that has been funded by the Department of Defense for me to do this, the moment I click onto a YouTube video, within minutes it's gone. The moment I click onto a Twitter that they've advertised, it's been taken down. So they have been very aggressive in shutting these things down. I know that, according to the news that I've read, they've hired thousands of people to hand code, to look through the content and remove it within minutes the moment it's flagged. I think the other thing we should mention, which is the positive side of the social media, has been it's precisely on Facebook and on these social media platforms where people can make sure that they're okay. They can let their friends know they're okay. There's the location, and there's in Facebook now, in the moment there's an attack, there's a button you can press. It also was a venue where in Manchester people could find places to stay if they couldn't get home, where they could find taxi drivers providing free transport at this current attack in London, where the Gujaras were providing food to people. So the positive elements of social media generally far outweigh the fact that the moment we clamp down on the existing social media platforms, it's just going to drive the terrorists to a new platform, which is how they ended up on Telegram, because of the aggressive closures and the policing that was going on in Facebook and in Twitter. So they just move around, and they don't have to, they're not hampered by the rule of law. They can do illegal things. It would be the equivalent of blaming the U.S. Postal Service for Ted Kaczynski's bombs. Instead of getting to the problem, you're looking at how the bombs were delivered in the mail. It wasn't the U.S. mail that was responsible.
Interesting. Really interesting point. Let's go to Phil, who's calling from Medford, Mass. Phil, you're on the air. Good to have you.
Hello, yes, thank you. Well, I've been doing internet security, web security now for over 20 years. I was with Tim Berners-Lee at CERN. And we've been having these attacks on the use of cryptography ever since we first started to propose using it. It's that cryptography that allows you to shop at Amazon. It's the cryptography that allows you to securely do $1 trillion worth of commerce a year. Every security problem that we have has a really simple answer. If you only care about one single problem, and what we have here is a politician who's in the middle of the election, comes in and there's a problem, and she has to divert the blame somewhere. And it's the old equation, we must do something, this is something, therefore we must do it. In UK terms, Charles Arthur, a dangerous dogs bill. That's what they're proposing. Yeah. They will legislate, and then we will regret it.
So, Charles Arthur, respond to Phil and sort of clarify that statement to a dangerous dogs bill.
Sure. The Dangerous Dogs Bill was brought in, it must have been in the 1990s sometime, as a response to a number of attacks by animals, dogs specifically, on a number of young children. When young children were killed by breeds which were owned by people who basically weren't taking enough care of them. And the dogs were dangerous. And they identified a number of breeds which you weren't allowed to own without having all sorts of measures such as muzzles and so on. But the trouble was that those breeds, you know, some of those breeds were dangerous, but not all those dogs were necessarily dangerous. And it also overlooked some other breeds whose dogs also could be dangerous.
Right. So it didn't address the real problem. It didn't address
It didn't get to the root of the problem. Right. Yeah, the root of the problem, which is really poor owner, dangerous owners, if you like. And although it did to some extent have an effect, it we still have occasions when children are killed by dangerous dogs, and the bill doesn't actually stop it. It simply means that the dog is killed, which would have been done anyway in the past. So yes, it's if you like, it's a dog's breakfast of legislation, but it's a knee-jerk thing because something must be done. And the danger of politicians feeling something must be done is that they do something which isn't the ideal thing to do.
Mia Bloom, I want to come back to this really intriguing idea that you brought up, that blaming the internet is a little bit like blaming the postal service for letter bombs. So, I mean, what is the solution? What would you like to see political leaders like Theresa May and our own political leaders here in this country propose in terms of encouraging more vigilance, more, I don't know, teamwork by the tech companies to address this issue? What should be done? What should be the political response be?
Well, the political response, which I think is something that Mr. Arthur referenced early in the conversation, is that it's reaching out to the communities, it's having off-ramps, it's having the opportunity for people to pick up the phone when they're concerned about their children who might be spending an inordinate amount of time online, who change their behavior, who start to parrot some of this jihadi propaganda. But from my perspective, the fact that each of these attackers in Britain ended up being known to the police, that to me means you need better security and follow-up and resources for the police if you have someone who's a known radical who could be dangerous versus trying to regulate the internet. And especially because many of these encrypted platforms that I've mentioned, for example, the Telegram, is a Russian company based in Germany. So attacking Silicon Valley isn't going to do anything to undermine Telegram, which is kind of where it's at right now for ISIS. And as soon as Telegram becomes an inhospitable environment, they move. So it's very difficult to regulate government policy, which is very laborious and slow and bureaucratic, when they're very fleet-footed and can just switch from one platform to the next very quickly.
Yeah, it sounds like sort of water flowing downhill. It's going to find a way to get down. We've got a couple of we've got quite a few responses on Facebook. I'm going to read just a couple of them. Frank Kalinsky writes, "The entire internet is predicated on one assumption, that everyone will use it only for correct behavior. We need to rewrite this basic code to use a system of checks and balances, much like our Constitution and Bill of Rights. Then a new type of government will evolve to maintain and regulate internet law. Now we have only anarchy." Different point of view from Eric Shane Hart, who writes, "Theresa May must pretend to be doing something. There is no way to regulate the internet without infringing on free speech. The simple fact, in free societies, there is no way to stop attacks like this." Charles Arthur, I'm curious. I know you've been writing about this as well. What about other governments in Europe? How are they responding to this issue?
Well, Germany is looking to introduce a law, and it seems to be moving through its parliament, to introduce a fine for companies which allow hate speech to remain online for longer than a certain period. And it's the sort of amount of money, I think it's around sort of $500 or so, which, if you have enough instances, then it's going to start attracting the attention of companies like Facebook and YouTube and so on. It's a sort of approach that I think would be unpopular in the States, but every country, every culture does these things differently. And I have to say, I think that while we're sort of talking about governments and the idea of government overreach, I think we also have to accept the fact that these companies have grown really fast, and that they are struggling themselves with the scale of the problems that have actually grown under their wings. Facebook and Google were both surprised by the scale and the effects of fake news. And I think that they're struggling, too, with the problems that they're finding now with extremism in all colors.
Well, that's Charles Arthur. He's contributing writer for The Guardian. Charles, thanks so much for joining us today and for bringing your expertise and your perspective. We're very, very grateful. And Mia Bloom, professor of communications at Georgia State University, thank you for being with us today as well. Great to have you.
Thank you. Thanks, Anthony. Thank you for having us.
Listeners, stay with us. After the break, we're going to look at President Trump's tweet storm over the travel ban as it heads to the Supreme Court. I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron. Blue Apron is the fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service you've heard about. Its mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to all. They support a more sustainable food system, set the highest standards for ingredients, and make it easy and fun to cook. You decide which recipes and how many meals you want each week. Change, pause, or cancel anytime. Learn more at blueapron.com/onpoint. Go now and get your first three meals free plus free shipping at blueapron.com/OP.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook. Early this morning, President Trump tweeted, "People, the lawyers and the courts can call it whatever they want, but I am calling it what we need, and what it is a travel ban." End quote. The president has shunned political correctness and has said the extreme vetting will keep America safe. The courts have blocked his ban, and it's now headed to the Supreme Court. But is this the right way to fight terrorism? You can join the conversation. What do you make of President Trump's travel ban? Is it constitutional? You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington, D.C. is Matt Zapotosky. He's Justice Department reporter for The Washington Post. And Matt, good to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Anthony. Thanks for having me.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is Daniel Benjamin. He's director of the John Sloan Dickey Center for International Understanding at Dartmouth College. He's a former coordinator for counterterrorism at the State Department, where he worked from 2009 to 2012. His recent piece in Politico is entitled, "Is Trump Fighting Terrorism, or Is He Just Tweeting About It While Making It Worse?" Daniel Benjamin, good to have you. Thanks for joining us.
No, thanks for having me.
Let me start with you, Matt, if I could. Just can you explain, just tell us a little, bring us up to date, I guess, about the president's tweet storm this morning and what exactly he's been saying and how it squares with what his administration has been putting out in terms of a message.
Well, so over the weekend, President Trump was reacting to the terror attack in London. He brought up the travel ban and for why he thinks it's necessary. So it clearly was on his mind. And then this morning, he launches into kind of a Twitter rant just after 6 in the morning. He says that, hey, this is a travel ban, despite what some people, including his own press secretary, has said. He says the Justice Department, you know, should have defended a first version of this ban, which was a lot more onerous than the second. He says that we're already doing extreme vetting, despite the courts having frozen his travel ban. And then he sort of talks about courts being slow and political. This is all really interesting to me because his travel ban is in the throes of a legal case. Right now it's gone up to the Supreme Court. We're waiting to hear from the challengers, the people who have sued over this ban. And all of the president's comments are going to become a part of the case and are very, very likely going to hurt his arguments in court. His comments are basically the reason that his travel bans have been frozen in the past, and now he's sort of undercutting his own lawyers by putting more, more comments, more assertions out there that are just detrimental to his case.
Yeah, just to be clear, because previously the courts have struck down or blocked this travel ban, ruling, among other things, that what he said on the campaign trail actually matters. And these tweets seem to echo a lot of those sentiments, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So on the campaign trail, he had called sort of outright for a Muslim ban. I think he said something like, we need a complete and total shutdown of Muslims
that's
entering
right.
the
yeah.
U.S. That's problematic because courts are having to decide whether this travel ban is actually a national security measure, or it's sort of a tool for discrimination disguised as a national security measure. Now, his lawyers have argued, like, look, what's said on the campaign trail should sort of stay on the campaign. That's just campaign rhetoric. When he's saying these things, echoing some of those sentiments, or at least connecting those sentiments to the present day, that's a lot more problematic for him. His lawyers now can't sort of go out and say, look, this was just all on the campaign. You can't really trust what people say on the stump. This is him, you know, long into his presidency, making proclamations about the travel ban.
Daniel Benjamin, I want to come to you. Your piece in Politico, which I really encourage folks to read, we link to it at On Point Radio. It's entitled, "Is Trump Fighting Terrorism, or Is He Just Tweeting About It While Making It Worse?" worse? Provocative question. I know you can't run through the whole piece, but answer that question a little bit and sort of spin out what you're thinking about as you look at this travel ban and as it heads to the Supreme Court.
Right. Well, I've written a lot about the travel ban, and I think that the issue, first of all, of the admissibility of what Trump said on the campaign would be less of an issue if the travel ban itself wasn't so obviously counterproductive to our efforts in counterterrorism. And that is a view shared by an overwhelming number of people who have served in senior positions in the counterterrorism community in the government. And 40 of us joined together and filed an amicus brief in the litigation, saying that it's bad because it is going to send a terrible message to exactly those domestic Muslim American communities that we rely on for early warning of problems with radicalization. It'll send a bad message to our partners abroad, who we rely on for intelligence. It will have all kinds of harsh humanitarian consequences. And, you know, we haven't had a case yet since 9/11 of some cell or operators coming in from abroad who had already been radicalized abroad to carry out terrorist attacks. So, you know, there are one or two marginal cases, including the woman involved in the San Bernardino shooting. But by and large, we've been the victims only of domestic self-starter homegrown terrorists. So that's one thing. You know, the central issue in my article is that actually Trump's political realignments of our relationships in the Middle East are going to come back to haunt us, because he has basically given the Saudis and the Gulf Arabs a big bear hug and has announced his resolve to do everything he can to confront Iran. Now, we do have the Iran, the nuclear deal there, which constrains him a bit because he doesn't want to break that himself, but it looks like they're trying to provoke the Iranians to break it. So, first of all, it'd be really bad if the Iranians did pull out and decided to race to get the bomb. But the other thing is that by embracing the Saudis, he's really embracing the sectarianism that has been ripping apart the Middle East since our occupation of Iraq. And sectarianism has been a major driver of radicalization. You just have to look at what's happened in Syria to know that. So, you know, I don't see this helping us and reducing the number of extremists over the long term.
Daniel Benjamin, I'd like to ask you, as someone who has served in the State Department and sort of understands some of the intricacies of dealing with policy, what the effect is of a president like Donald Trump who resorts to Twitter in the way that he does. You know, we were talking to Matt about this tweet storm this morning over the weekend. I know he went over after the mayor of London and quoted him sort of out of context, suggesting that he wasn't taking terrorism seriously. He doubled down on that earlier today and tweeted out, "Pathetic excuse by London Mayor Sadiq Khan, who had to think fast on his no reason to be alarmed statement. Mainstream media is working hard to sell it." What does that do to these efforts, and how do you imagine tweets like this are being perceived overseas?
America's leadership in the world for 70 years has been based on close relationships between like-minded partners who, at the end of the day, had each other's back and who would defend each other and always work to be constructive. This is obviously the antithesis of that. And while the professionals in government are going to do their level best to provide our long-term partners with every bit of support we can, this will make us more unpopular, more disliked, and will ultimately have political ramifications. And I pity our diplomats and the many other people who are in embassies abroad. You know, it's filled with people from the Defense Department, intelligence community, you name it. And I pity them who have to go to work in this atmosphere, trying to build the relationships that make us safer, more secure, and ultimately more prosperous you know, with this kind of background noise going on, it's disastrous for our international relationships.
Listeners, we're talking about President Trump's proposed travel ban as it heads to the Supreme Court and the way he's been tweeting about it this morning. Here's an example. The Justice Department should have stayed with the original travel ban, not the watered-down, politically correct version they submitted to the Supreme Court. Then he tweeted after that, the Justice Department should have stayed with the original ban, not the watered-down one. That's the same one. Here's another one. The Justice Department should ask for an expedited hearing of the watered-down travel ban before the Supreme Court and seek much tougher version. Matt, are the folks around President Trump, that if you've managed to talk to them, are they providing sort of off-the-record background to put these tweets in some kind of perspective that makes sense?
You know, the Justice Department just declined to comment on this. I haven't been able to get sort of any whispers like the ones you mentioned, but I can almost guarantee you that the lawyers who have had to defend the travel ban, you know, probably have significant heartburn over these tweets. You know, and the two that you read are particularly interesting. The first one, where he says the Justice Department should have stayed with the original travel ban, it was the president who signed an executive order revoking and revising the travel ban. It wasn't the Justice Department. These guys are just the lawyers in the civil division who have to defend what the president does. It's really interesting that, I mean, these tweets are almost acting like he's not the president, and that he's just a sort of person on the street criticizing the administration. The revoking of the first travel ban was him, and the Justice Department is just defending what he has done. So, I mean, I'm just puzzled by this, and I'm sure that, you know, the lawyers who have to defend this are, you know, probably beyond puzzled.
Let's take a couple of calls. We've got a lot of listeners who want to get in on this conversation about Trump's proposed travel ban. Peter is calling from Vienna, Austria. Peter, good to have you on the air.
Hi, Anthony. I'm wondering, I think this travel ban doesn't make any sense because all these attackers are normally already in these countries where they carry out the attacks. So,
you're saying that the people that we should be most worried about are already in the country. Is that one of the points you're making?
Yeah, that's the point I make, because if this, like the travel ban, they get even more angrier, their families got killed in their countries. So I'm actually wondering that there are so little attacks, because there are so many people angry, I think, out there.
Peter, I'm really glad you put that point on the table, and I want to take it up. I want to move on to another caller first, though. Thank you for calling, Peter, from Vienna there. Let's go to David, who's calling from Des Moines, Iowa. David, you're on the air. Good to have you.
Hi, thank you. My question is, when this ban was originally proposed, they said it's not permanent. It's a 90-day pause so we can review policies. Well, since it was initially proposed, it's been well over 90 days. So what's the need for the ban now? Couldn't they have completed that review?
Interesting question, David. Matt Zapatosky, is there a way you can respond to David? I mean, I suppose the answer from the administration would be, well, we haven't had that 90-day freeze yet because we haven't had the ban.
Yeah, so it's an interesting question, and one that I think Democrats and even Republicans were raising on the Sunday talk shows here this week. But the answer is a little complicated. A judge in Hawaii told the government fairly recently, "Look, you have to stop even doing your review your review of vetting procedures." So the government interpreted that as, "Hey, we got to put our pens down. We don't have the 90 days. We're stopped." The people on the other side say, that isn't true. You're sort of blocked from just doing this particular review that was contemplated by the travel ban, but of course you can still come up with new vetting procedures. You can globally look at what we're doing. And then today, one of the president's tweets was, in any event, we are extreme vetting people coming into the United States. The travel ban, as it was proposed initially and in the revised version, was supposed to give them time to come up with these extreme vetting procedures. If they're already doing that, I think that does really undercut the argument that it is needed. And now, I think the most skeptical people would say, look, even though this ban says it's supposed to be temporary, President Trump never really contemplated that way, that he always thought this was a permanent ban. And you can kind of see that in his first tweet where he says, you know, you can call it whatever you want, but I'm calling it what we need and what it is, which is a travel ban. That's not a pause, which I think some people have tried to characterize it as. says, and that's not like a bigger level of vetting. That's a ban, and he doesn't say a temporary ban either.
Yeah. Daniel Benjamin, I'd love it if you could respond to our caller from Austria talking about suggesting that the real threat comes from people who are already in the country, so a travel ban makes no sense.
He's right on point. I think he's got it right, and I think that one of the facts that gets lost in this debate, because historically our leaders haven't wanted to brag about this because it would set them up for some kind of failure, is that after 9/11, there was an extraordinary amount of innovation and reform that went on in U.S. immigration systems. The amount of vetting that goes on is already tremendous. As I mentioned before, no one's come in from abroad and carried out an attack. You know, we're fortunate that pretty much anyone who'd want to come from abroad to harm us has to fly here. They have not really managed to exploit our land borders. And so, you know, most of the national security professionals I know keep looking at this and saying, you know, this is crazy. We already subject everyone coming into the country to extreme vetting. We have dozens of databases that are consulted, huge amounts of information and intelligence. We've required all of our visa waiver partners to give us access to all kinds of information about people coming from their country. So, you know, I think the caller, you know, is onto something here, and this is just another reason why this ban looks more discriminatory than genuinely focused on national security.
Well, we'll see. It is moving toward the Supreme Court. Matt Zapatosky, a final sort of 10 seconds from you. What are you watching for next in this story?
Well, next week, the people who have sued over this ban have to file with the Supreme Court. We'll be looking for that filing, and we'll be looking to see to what extent the president's tweets come up in that filing. I imagine they will be quoted extensively.
All right. That's Matt Zapatosky, Justice Department reporter for The Washington Post. Matt, thank you so much for joining us today. Very grateful to have you.
Thank you.
And Daniel Benjamin, director of the John Sloan Dickey Center for International Understanding at Dartmouth College. Thank you, Daniel Benjamin.
My pleasure.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.